Welcome to the Radio Cafe, here broadcasting live at the Community College today. We're not at the Baking Company. It's a fabulous day out there for those of you who are out and about, and those of you who are not out and about, get up. It's absolutely gorgeous. One of those wonderful, clear, pristine days. I discovered this morning that the sunrise is as good as the sunsets here in Santa Fe. I am your strange host, as you can tell. It's Desiree Mays, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. Mary Charlotte's taking a well-deserved break, and I'm delighted to be here and to be invited to host the show today. Mary Charlotte will be back next Monday. She'll be back on the job. So when I looked at the calendar after she asked me to host this show, I realized that it was the second day of Hanukkah, the Jewish holiday. So I thought, well, it'd be really interesting to find someone who could really talk about the Jewish holidays, this one in particular. So I'm delighted to have with me a very special guest who flew in late last night, though she lives here, and she's here in the studio bright and early. She's actually the author of many books that run the full gamut from children's books, such as the Jewish ABC of Holidays, a wonderful kids book called Grandma's Latkes, and we're going to talk about latkes today, a book on Frida Kahlo, and a book called White Fire that I hope that we will get to before the end of the show this morning. She is a lady rabbi, and this is probably her most important job in life, and her name is Malka Drucker of the Hamakom. I knew I would get that wrong. The Hamakom congregation here in Santa Fe. So thank you so much, Malka, for coming, and I'm dying to get into talking to you about and not just Hanukkah, but the symbolism, meaning of these wonderful holidays. So welcome.
Thanks very much, Desiree.
So if you'd like to take it away, and we'll get into Hanukkah, and we're going to play some music about the holiday, in connection with the holidays, that's great. Where did this holiday come from? It has a historical base, of course.
Yes, it does. It's actually in what's known as the Apocrypha part of the writings, sacred writings, and it's the story that has a lot of meaning for today, because it's about the struggle to live in two worlds. And the miracle, for me, has always, the traditional story of the miracle is that when the small Maccabees were able to overcome the mighty Syrians and they returned to the temple and they found it desecrated, they cleaned it up, and then they discovered that they only had enough oil in the eternal lamp to burn for one day, and they couldn't get to oil for 8 days. So they lit it with the faith that somehow it would last, or they would find oil, and sure enough, it lasted for 8 days. By the time I was 8 years old, I found that story hard to believe, that we had been celebrating oil lasting for 8 days for 2,000 years, and I began to dig more deeply for myself and discovered that there's a more interesting story, that there were 8 spears lying on the ground of this desecrated space. And it was, after all, a war for religious freedom. And these spears were set upright, and they were lit, and they became instruments of killing, transformed into instruments of holiness. Mm. To me, today, the real miracle is that Jews have found a way to live in two worlds in many civilizations. They haven't had to sequester themselves. They've managed to, like a fiddler on the roof, keep balance of taking the best of the culture in which and the time in which they live, as well as holding on to their root tradition. This, to me, is really a miracle.
Absolutely, and it's a miracle, this particular one, based on oil, which was still an issue we're still dealing with on a daily basis. This was the time of Alexander?
That's right, mm-hmm. And Alexander really had the most amazing product in the world to sell, Hellenism. It was the most graceful and enlightened of cultures, to use the metaphor of the season. And in Palestine, as well as the rest of the world that he conquered, people loved everything about Hellenism.
Including, at this point, there was collaboration between the two cultures?
Absolutely. I mean, and many Jews changed their names from Joshua to Jason and wanted to be able to enjoy the fruits of Hellenism. And it was fine. And they lived in both. And then there were those Jews, like there are Jews today, who would say, you can't have both. You're going to weaken the tradition. But then there were other Jews who said, no, I can do this. And not until they were, their backs were to the wall.
What shifted? What changed things so that suddenly they had to be defensive?
What happened was is that they were caught in a war between the North and the South.
Geographically,
between the Egyptians and between what were the Babylonians. So in the fight for Palestine, they were caught in these two places. And ultimately, the North wins, Syria, and the villain of the story is Antiochus, who is the Syrian. He's the leader of the people. He sees a schism in the Jews. His main problem with the Jews is he'll let them do anything they want as long as they pay their taxes. But he sees that who's in charge here? So he comes in and he says, I'll tell you who's in charge here. The Hellenists are going to be in charge here. Then those moderates who sort of enjoyed living in both said, wait a minute. I'm being told now by an external force that I can't keep the Sabbath. I can't eat as follow the laws of Kashrut, the dietary laws.
Yes, there was terrible desecration in the temple.
That's right. And I can't circumcise.
Mm.
So now those moderates
are pushed.
Were moved a little bit over to the zealot side. So the zealots and the moderates formed an alliance. And again, the miracle to me is not only that they were lived in the two worlds, and we continue to do that, but that they were not so terrified that they gave in to despair. And I often feel like maybe the reason Jews are still around is everybody today is worried about world destruction, omnicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, the thing about Jews is, I mean, look at them. They've been on the edge of extinction from the day they were born. And I learned this also from friends of mine with AIDS. There's a way to continue to live and love in this moment, and that all of us will prevail. The miracle will be that we will overcome our fear and our despair to continue to live and love.
Mm, I think we have to. It's the only way to survive, and the Jewish people have proven this. So the Greeks literally ran over the people at that time, and then this ceremony was the rededication of the temple.
That's right. You've really done your homework on this, Desiree.
Oh,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I have many wonderful friends to whom I remember. My children were reared in Utah, and we're not Mormon, and so we were actually Jewish for those years, I think, and very much part of those wonderful traditions with wonderful friends who included us in Passover and the holidays. So I believe, as many people here do, and as I think your book Quiet Fire says, that we are finding the commonalities in all of these faiths, and we're looking beyond rules, regulations, and structure, and finding that commonality with wonderful people, and it's the way to go.
Well, I think that's true, and again, it goes back to this struggle the Jews are always confronted with, which is that God has put us in a place to live in two places, and the other piece of it is, Desiree, is that It's also the lesson that it's all right to be the weaker. It's all right to be the smaller. I mean, women know this, that maybe there's the risk of being corrupted by power is too great for almost every human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that for most of us, the acceptance of being the smaller and not seeing it as the inferior is very important mm-hmm. as well. And the word Hanukkah means dedication.
Oh, it does.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So when they return to rededicate the temple, they rededicate it in an entirely different way. I mean, the temple really was ultimately destroyed 150 years after this event. This happens around 165 BC, BCE.
Mm-hmm.
When this is the beginning of the end and the beginning of the beginning. It's the beginning of the Jesus movement, and it's the beginning of a different form of Judaism that does not rely upon a place where there are animal sacrifices. So now everything has to become more subtle, more enlightened, if you will. And the metaphor of this little light, now we no longer have the blaze of the sacrifice, the physical. But instead, there's the small light that becomes the symbol for the light within ourselves that will not be extinguished. And I find that, you know, I'm still moved by this story again and again. I mean, one of the favorite sidebars, we're talking about white fire for a moment, is the girl side of the story. Because the rabbis, I mean, the Jews are really... I mean, we're supposed to be a tender people. That's the energy. And the rabbis were extremely unhappy with a holiday that would celebrate war. So that's why they put the emphasis on the miracle. But here's a particularly interesting opposite vision of what women are about in times of war. The story goes that there was a woman named Judith. And I uncovered this story about 23 years ago. Now it's fairly well known. Judith was a cousin of Judah Maccabee, the hero of the Jews, the general of the army. She wanted to fight. He said, "You can't. You're a girl. Make soup." She objected. And she decided that she would set out to prove to her cousin and to help her people. There was a general, Holofernes, who was crazy about her. She wouldn't look at him. She decided to use what she had. Packs a basket filled with cheese and wine, and knocks on the tent of Holofernes. Astonished and delighted to see her, he ushers her in. He says, "Let me prepare a feast." She said, "No, I'm kosher. I brought food for both of us." She prepares this. She pulls out the cheese, which is very salty, and she cuts him large pieces of it. He eats the cheese. He says, "Oh, I'm really thirsty. Have some wine." Drinks the wine. Drinks enough wine that he passes out. At this moment, she unsheathes his sword, and she beheads him.
That's the famous story. Yes, a wonderful story.
That's right. You see the statues all over Europe.
And the art. It's in art everywhere. Judith and Holofernes. I didn't know that was
that's the story behind it.
That's wonderful. So she stayed in her role as a domestic woman, but she acted the role of a soldier at the same time.
That's right. And it's one of the reasons that we're supposed to eat dairy during Hanukkah to remember the cheese she served Holofernes.
Oh, at this time, at the same time of the Maccabees. I didn't realize. Huh? I found a comment here that I wonder what you think of. It is bitterly ironic that this holiday of Hanukkah, which has its roots in a revolution against assimilation and the suppression of the Jewish religion, has become the most assimilated secular holiday on our calendar.
Well, here's an interesting thing. When I first started thinking about the holiday, I made very clear in my first children's book about this that it was not appropriate for Jewish children to celebrate Christmas. It was disrespectful of Christians, and it was confusing for Jews.
And vice versa, yes, exactly.
That's right. And that it would be the same, I said, that if David had a birthday, and you liked birthdays so much, you decided to take David's birthday also, not only your own. That was over 20 years ago. I used to give talks called How to Hear the Shema When the Christmas Bells Are Ringing. I realize now I was spinning in the wind. You have to really go where things go. And the truth is this holiday, which does speak about the risk of assimilation, has become for many Jews the great holiday of Jewish identity. I mean, this is ironic.
Because it is nearly a secular holiday. It doesn't have the religious significance of the other high holidays, right?
No, this is a minor holiday, Desiree. You're exactly right. It's a holiday where you work. I'll tell you why it's so popular. Look, first of all, you don't have to go to temple. This right away puts it at the top of the heap. It's very cheery. There are very few prohibitions attached to it. A menorah can be virtually anything. I spoke to my son last night, and he couldn't find his, so he fashioned one out of aluminum foil. I mean,
So
those are two nice things about it. There's no fear of doing it the wrong way. It's very cheerful, even though it has a very bloody history. And yes, it sweeps into Christmas, and like Christmas, it's tainted with excessive commercialism. But what I have seen is that for a lot of Jewish kids, they're going to love seeing that big menorah put up in the plaza. They're going to think this is just rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You know, those of us who are queasy about church and state, et cetera, it's another story.
It's another historical roller coaster too, though, because, you know, they've been one and the same and then separate and one and the same and separate over history, and right now it's questionable as to where they are. They're not too separate if you look at the world picture in terms of aggression and war. And coming from Ireland, I understand all that situation.
I agree with you, and I mean, if I were queen of the world, I would absolutely keep. Look, it's like, you know, all intimate relationships should be private. And it seems to me our relationship with our God is the most intimate that we have. And I don't want to walk into a restaurant and hear "down on your knees," you know, we're a little town in Bethlehem. And I don't want to, you know, certainly see in public places the Christmas trees and all of this. But it's there. So it's going to be there. And you're going to be surrounded by it. Mm-hmm. And this is, after all, a Christian country. And even Jews see the world Christologically. Then I say, okay, so if the response is going to be on the other side, that we're going to be making equal to-do of things, and it makes Jews feel better about being Jews, go for it.
And everyone should have the right to be able to show their own symbols. I'm sure if one was in Israel, one would be in the minority if you had a Christmas tree and not a menorah at this time of the year. So it's the same thing. I've noticed this traveling. You know, what we take for granted here is not going to happen somewhere else. I spent Christmas in the Middle East one year, and there was nothing whatsoever to remind me of Christmas. So I can empathize with that. Well, we're going to play some music today. Mickey Brown is engineering for us, and the first piece of music that you've brought for us is the Rock of Ages. Why did you choose this, Marka?
Well, I chose it for two reasons, Desiree. First of all, Rock of Ages is a song that two traditions have. So, first of all, I thought that Christians might be interested in hearing a different version of it. Specifically, this is the song that we sing during this holiday. And the version that I've chosen here happens to be in English, but the words are very much the story of Hanukkah, that in the end, what the rabbis wanted us to remember again and again was, it wasn't our strength that prevailed, but that it was the rock, that the metaphor for God, who prevailed. And again, is that when we lean against the rock, then we survive. Mm-hmm. And that's what the song is about.
Great. And this comes from a CD called Festival of Light. Thanks, Mickey.
Just let our song praise your saving power. Thou midst the raging foes, you were our sheltering tower, our sheltering tower. Thy saving power, thou midst the raging force, you were our sheltering tower, our sheltering tower. Assailed us, but thine arm availed. their sword when our own strength failed us. And your word broke their sword when our own strength failed us. Oh, rock of ages. Oh, yeah. Children of the wanderers, whether free, whether free or fettered, wake the echoes, wake the echoes of the song, where you may be scattered, where you may be scattered.
Of our programming is partially underwritten by the Santa Fe Reporter, providing local news and complete arts and entertainment information to more than 50,000 readers each week. Now in its 30th year, the Reporter is available every Wednesday at over 300 locations in Santa Fe and the surrounding area. For pickup locations, go to the Reporter's website, sfreporter.com.
The Sangre de Cristo Chorale will perform at 7:30 p.m. in Santa Fe on Thursday, December 9th, and in Los Alamos on Saturday, December 11th. On Sunday, December 12th, the chorale will host a dinner concert at La Fonda Hotel, advance reservations required. The concert, titled Love Came Down at Christmas, will feature Poulenc's Gloria, four Spanish carols, three Israeli songs, and some old favorites. For tickets and information, call 505-989-1192. This message sponsored by the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, a tax-exempt organization.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe, and this is not Mary Charlotte. She'll be back next week. It's Desiree Mays, and I'm delighted to have as my guest today Rabbi Malka Drucker. We're talking about Hanukkah. We're in the second of the 8 days. And let's talk a little now about the physical symbols of this feast. We have the menorah. What is the tradition of the candle lighting? How does that work?
Well, it's a good question. You know, with the two Jews, you'll have seven opinions. So when there was to be a remembrance of this holiday, how would it be observed? So they're late in our tradition, hundreds of years after Hanukkah, the idea of lighting a candle for the eight nights, to mark the eight nights. And we talked about why it was eight, possibly the oil lasting, which is one of the reasons one of the symbols is latkes, potato pancakes, because they're made in oil. But the other reason was that that maybe they were celebrating another holiday that had occurred, the fall harvest holiday in October, that was 8 days long. So they're going to mark it, but they have to mark it differently. That holiday is celebrated in a hut, the sukkah. Mm. So now they're going to light. So now the question is, how do you light? Do you light 8 the first night down to 1, 1 up to 8? So the principle in all things in Judaism is to move towards increasing joy. So we begin with the one small one. And when you light them on the right. The first one is the first candle, in other words, is on the right of the candelabra.
As the Hebrew writing goes, right to left.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the best reason I can understand you do it this way, mm-hmm. with this way you do it. And there's a special candle, a worker candle called the shamash, that lights the other candles.
As you mentioned this earlier, what is the shamash?
Well, the shamash is the extra candle, the ninth candle in the candelabra, in the Chanukiah, the Hanukkah menorah, that so that one candle does not, one of those 8 nights does not work in the service of the other, and that then the next candle is put next to it the second night for the second. Tonight is the third night. The first candle you light is the new candle because that's its night. So it has supremacy over the other candles. It is the third night's candle. You light that new candle tonight. And that each one of these little candles, the candles, it says, is very wonderful in the Talmud. It says, don't use these lights for any practical purpose. Specifically, do not count your money by them. These lights are for their beauty, to proclaim the miracle, and traditionally they should be put at the door so people passing by can see the menorahs lit. And if you're in a place like New York, let alone Jerusalem, mm-hmm. you really will see menorahs in people's windowsills. Mm-hmm. So there, in fact, Isaac Besheva Singer has a marvelous story about this. So these lights each night increase, and they're put out there for the miracle, and that leads us to the where dreidel comes from and games come from, because what are you going to do while they're burning?
And how long do they have to burn? What is the ritual? It happens at night. Is there other prayers or blessings? Is it in connection with a meal, the lighting? How does it actually happen? It happens in every Jewish household, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's very nice. Other festival candles, including the Sabbath candles, have to be lit 18 minutes before sundown. And it's always all this, oh, am I going to get everything done in time to get in right now?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the great thing about Hanukkah candles, except on Shabbos, is on the Sabbath, is that it's not so strict about it. The rule is they should be lit when everyone is home from work and everyone is still awake. So it means that the children, as well as the adults, everybody is present. That's when you light the candles. Mm-hmm. And they have to burn for at least a half an hour. So that's the whole symbol of it.
So this is one of the great strengths, I think, of the Jewish holidays, is my impression, that they are so holistic within the family. The children are always included, and they're reared on this dialogue of discussion as to which is the right or the wrong way to do it, and then the wonderful veneration that's brought to it, and the food that's always part of it. You said in, was it the children's book, Grandma's Latkes, that food has meaning in our history, and I connect the two. How does that come about? I mean, it's such an integral part of Jewish ritual. Let's talk about latkes.
Latkes are these little potato pancakes. You know, I made a terrible mistake in that book, actually, in Grandma's Latkes, and I could never get the publisher to take it out when I realized what had happened. Because you know very well, Desiree, coming from Ireland, you know, the potato is a New World food. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in the ancient world. So clearly, you know, Jews didn't eat latkes.
With potatoes, right? But they had matzah meal.
Well, yeah, they had matzah for sure. Mm-hmm. But actually in Israel, the traditional Hanukkah food is not latkes, which is a Yiddish word, but jelly donuts, sufganiot.
Oh, amazing. So, which is a Western food.
That's right. Yeah. But again, they're fried in oil. Mm-hmm. So, and my community this year is having its Hanukkah party, and we're going to have both latkes and sufganiot. And we decided to make this year, as a little fundraiser, rugelach, which is another Eastern European mm-hmm. pastry. But you want to talk about, you know, like really high fat content. You know, this is like 98%. It's cream cheese and butter, you know.
Yeah.
So we saw, those were our Hanukkah foods, but I thought, well, it's oil, you know.
And that's the reason, the oil.
And I always ask kids, you know, how do they like their latkes? You know, some with jelly, some with sugar, some apple with peanut butter, applesauce, sour cream. You know, if you're Eastern European, the sour cream is always part of your potato diet. Then as I became older and more sybaritic, I added caviar to that. Mm-hmm. I love latkes.
I want to come to your latke party.
Well, you're welcome.
And what about the dreidel?
Now, the dreidel is interesting because the dreidel, again, comes late. It comes from the Eastern European tradition. There are some who say that when, in the time of Roman occupation, the Jews who were not allowed to read their Torah would quickly put it away and play a little spinning game. So that may be part of...
It was a cover-up for the reading of the Torah. So it's actually a top with square sides?
That's right. But we also know that in Germany there were tops that had four letters, and it was a gambling game. Uh-huh. So sivivon is the word in Hebrew and dreidel in Yiddish, and you'd spin the dreidel, and so the rabbis really hated they didn't like the idea of military victory. Well, they liked the idea of gambling even less.
Mm-hmm.
However, the game is there, so how are you going to sanctify the game? Well, first of all, the letters on the dreidel, Nes Gadol Hayah Sham, mean a great miracle happened there.
Hmm.
In Israel, it's a different letter. A great miracle happened here.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But then that messes up the other thing the rabbis played with, which was every Hebrew letter has a numeric equivalent. The Aleph, the A, is 1, Bet, B, 2, etc. So the numeric equivalent of these four letters was 358, which is the same, coincidentally, as the letters in the word Moshiach, or Messiah.
So they found a wonderful connection. Perfect. So the gambling was for money, for chocolate coins, or how is that tradition used now, or is it used now?
Well, the gifts the great gift giving of Hanukkah. We have Christmas to thank for that. The way that Hanukkah was celebrated was never with real gifts, you know. It was Hanukkah Geld, Shalom Aleichem story, great story. Hanukkah Geld was Hanukkah gold, literally, little gold coins. And you played with coins. You played dreidel with coins. Then the little coins, the little chocolate coins covered in foil, gold foil, became part of the holiday as well. But really the only day that gifts were given was on the fifth day, and they were given to teachers, really, and to students.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of children were students, so then they knew on the fifth day they get some coins.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very wonderful holiday, you know.
It's a lovely tie-in with a play aspect of spirituality. That's great. Well, actually, as luck would have it, your second choice of music is called Latke. Tell us about the CD by Debbie Friedman.
Yeah, Debbie Friedman actually is a wonderful, wonderful singer and composer of Jewish music. She was really the first to recognize that all of us had grown up on rock and roll, and minor key songs weren't going to get us home, and song is what opens the heart. So Debbie, who began working, I think, at 18 and 19, composing and singing, has become really the doyen of contemporary Jewish music. Now two generations of children have grown up on it. She's also a dear friend. I've had the great pleasure and privilege of doing High Holidays with her here in Santa Fe. I hope we get to do it again. She lives in New York. And this is a song she wrote, which I adore, called The Latke Song. And, you'll just hear it. And it's the song of Hanukkah from the perspective of being a latke.
Great. Good. So let's hear this. Thanks, Mickey.
Sitting in the splendor, turning brown. Madrid will have its 22nd annual open house the first three weekends in December. Visits with Santa Claus, Christmas lights, balloon glow, stagecoach rides, plus much more. Christmas in Madrid is sponsored in part by the Madrid Cultural Projects, a nonprofit 501c3, PNM, Century Bank, Home Depot, Ace Hardware of Santa Fe, Sam's Club, and Walmart. For more information about Christmas in Madrid, 438-0782.
This program is underwritten in part by the new Journal Santa Fe, your daily newspaper covering Santa Fe and northern New Mexico, now featuring new sections on local business, lifestyle, sports, and neighborhoods, as well as the Journal's complete coverage of world, national, and state news. The Journal Santa Fe.
Welcome back to the Radio Cafe. I am your host of the day, Desiree Mays. And before I get back to my fascinating guest this morning, Rabbi Malka Drucker, I want to just remind people that the Santa Fe Ski Basin opens tomorrow, folks. So dig those dusty skis out of the garage. Not just brush them off, but why don't you wax them and tune them, check your bindings, all that good stuff, and head up onto the mountain. I talked yesterday with Sandy Brickner, who is one of the great ski instructors of all time, who tells me that there is 27 inches of good snow and all of the lower runs are open. So this is the time to go, actually, before that Christmas, all those outsiders come in and ski the mountain. So head up to the mountain. He says that these hills are well-groomed. He says these are the best groomers in the business. I ski up there. I know that's true. So everything is open on the lower mountain, except there are no bump runs at this point, so don't bring your bump skis. There's lots of things to do at the ski basin, of course. There's the Chipmunk School, where you can kids can hang out for the day. They'll teach them how to ski. Sandy will teach, and he actually has a wonderful course for people, I think they're over 50 is a sort of the criteria, but they're not checking your birth certificates. Starts on January the 10th. For a lot of people who want to ski but don't want to ski on their own, this is a great sort of get-together group. You go with a group of like-minded people, most of whom can ski, and he'll put you into different grade levels, so to speak. It also introduces you to new runs on the mountain that you might not have discovered or might not want to take off on your own. So avoid the Christmas rush. You get up onto the mountain and ski. That time is here. That's really exciting. The number up there is 924429, or you can go online and get all the information at skisantafe.com /snow. So go ski and may see you up there if I can get out. Now let's get back. Oh, one more thing actually before we go back to my guest. John Greenspan's classical afternoon show follows this afternoon at 12:30, and in honor of Hanukkah, he's going to play the entire oratorio Judas Maccabeus of Handel. That'll start about 12:30. I don't have the recording details, but he'll have that for you at 12:30. So that'll be something to really tune into. Well, now let's get back to my guest, Malka Drucker. And a question, ever since I knew I was going to talk with you, I wanted to know, how do you get to be, how do you study to be, how is it in this day and age now, because this was not possible in the past, become a lady rabbi?
Women have been ordained now, Desiree, for close to 30 years, and the reform movement began this. I entered the seminary late. I entered the seminary in the beginning of 1996. I had made my first run for it in 1985. Personally, when people ask me why I did this, I say I couldn't help it. It's like my mother said, the only reason to get married is you can't help it. You have to. Well, I guess I just couldn't not do it. And I never intended to have a pulpit. I am a writer. I've been a writer for 30 years. But I couldn't get ordained unless I had a pulpit. So I was forced into this congregation up in Westchester, New York, and I fell in love, and I was hooked. And when I returned to Santa Fe, I realized that I liked the work very much, and it wasn't just academic for me, and that what we can do in community is and is very much what it's about being a Jew. You can't be a Jew alone. It is not just relationship between you and your God, because while each of us is in the divine image, God dwells between us, so we need a between. And because of that, we started the holy experiment, HaMakom, the place for passionate and progressive Judaism, 3 years ago.
Now, that's the full name of your congregation. Tell us again, because that's a marvelous
It is a mouthful. It's HaMakom, which means the place. It's one of God's names, so that we create makom in how we are with each other. Mm-hmm. Because the way we serve God is by serving one another.
Mm-hmm. That the God is within.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you expressed to me a natural curiosity about the different denominations of Judaism. And historically there are three, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, ranging from the most liberal to the most traditional. It's a fairly new construct. Denominational Judaism is only about 150 years old.
That's brand new.
And for me, who's never been able to quite fit in any box very comfortably in any part of my life, it never quite worked. You know, there were things that made me Reform, things that made me Conservative, things that made me Orthodox. So when we created HaMakom, especially here in Santa Fe, where for many people, I mean, this is not, the relevance is, I just want to get close to God.
It's spirituality rather than a specific name given
exactly.
to a congregation. I agree. I think.
Exactly.
I mean, I think this is true of Catholicism, Protestantism as well. You see the walls breaking down a little of the structure. It's changed a lot since I was a child in Ireland, thank goodness. Thank
that's
God, right?
That's right. And I think that that's exactly correct. And that's why I decided to, it was really about passion, the passion of, say, Hasidic Orthodox Judaism. Yet that wasn't enough, especially if you're a woman, because your place in that is problematic.
Hey, to this day, I mean, a woman cannot be a rabbi in the Orthodox Church. Is that true?
It is true, although de facto leadership is there. More and more you see that. And then the other is the progressive aspect is very important. I mean, really, one of the ways to manifest God is by creating social change towards justice and kindness.
Across the board.
Across the board.
Mm. And across all faiths.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And yet, pure progressivism is not enough, because what makes us work is love. So that's why I wanted it to be both passionate and progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was the idea, to create a laboratory here of a different form of organization, small, first of all, a community that would only have a 25% professional leadership. It could only do that if they were willing, and its leadership was willing, to train them to be a community, to use other traditions, of deacons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so the whole community is a diaconate.
Mm-hmm. And you use music as a tool. You describe it as a singing congregation. How does that work?
First of all, we have a tradition in Hasidism of the wordless melody, the nigun, we call it. So why do we do that? Well, first of all, there's a good practical reason, which is that nobody has to know the words and nobody has to worry about them. Secondly, it also gives us the humility to remember, you know, God's listening, but what is God listening for? It's not for those lovely words as much as the cry of the heart. And that nigun needs to come from the heart.
Actually, this brings up a story I read online. And let's give your online address, because some of your wonderful talks and sermons are on there. What is your address online?
My website?
Your website, yeah.
The website is my name. It's malkadrucker.com.
Okay, let's remember that. And that reminds me of a story you're talking about. It's not what the words mean. It's the child with the alphabet in the synagogue. Can you tell? We've time just to tell that story. And then, Mickey, perhaps at the end we'll go to the last piece, so we'll hear the Hanukkah blessings if we could. But can you tell us that story, Marcus? Wonderful, about a commitment of faith without understanding words or needing the right words.
It's a story of a little boy who is very poor and has never learned to read, and it's the holiest day of the year. And the greatest rabbi of the 19th century, the Baal Shem Tov, it's the fast day, and it's getting late in the afternoon, and the rabbi is coming nowhere close to bringing the prayers to a close, and people are getting hungry, and they don't know what he's waiting for, but they would never, ever presume to question what he's doing. Meanwhile, there's this little boy, and the little boy is outside the door of the synagogue, and his father says, "Don't even bother going in. You won't understand a word of what's happening. You don't know how to pray. You don't know how to read." But the little boy's heart is so, so desiring to be close to God on this day that all Jews are praying, and doesn't know what to do, but just works all that day and works all that day, but and the day goes on and on and on, and the sun is beginning to set, and the little boy just can't hold himself back anymore, and he runs into the center of the synagogue, and he begins to recite the only words he knows in Hebrew, and they're not even words. All it is that his mother had taught him was the alphabet, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. And he sings these words of each letter with such fervor and such delight that for the first time all day, the Baal Shem Tov begins to smile, because he knows that it is this passion, this love, that God is listening for. And with these words, the Baal Shem Tov concludes the service, because God has finally heard the prayer. God needs to know that the Jewish people are ready to gain the forgiveness of the day.
That's the most beautiful story, and a very lovely lead-in, perhaps, to the Hanukkah blessings that we're going to hear from the CD of this is from Debbie Friedman's CD. No, yes, it is. Okay, we're going to talk about that. Before we actually get into that, though, are there services, or how can people find out about your services, and how is it possible for people to come? When is a Hanukkah? So we touched on that briefly. Tell us about that, Marco, before we have to finish here.
The name of our community, again, is Hamakom. We have a website, hamakomtheplace.org, and we always keep all our information posted on that. That being said, our telephone number is 992-1905. We're having a Hanukkah party this Sunday. If you're interested, please give us a call. It's a potluck dairy dinner, and we'll be lighting candles and playing Hanukkah games. And if you'd like information about Hamakom, the same number, we can give you that. Every Saturday morning, we meet with my good brother, my good brother's church, St. Bede's Episcopal Church. Saturday morning in the library, we have Sabbath morning services, and everyone is welcome to that. And we have monthly services as well. And
good, so there are many ways then of getting in touch, so let's bear that in mind. And now I'm afraid we are going to have to finish up today. It's been so wonderful having you. Thank you so much, Marco, for coming. Rabbi Marco Drucker from the Congregation Hamakom, which is just spelled just as it sounds, right? Hamakom. And on the second day of Hanukkah, we would like to end the show with the Hanukkah blessings. Sa
I'm Juanita Thorne-Connerty from the Sisters of Northern New Mexico, an African-American women's group. We invite you to join Kwanzaa celebrating traditional African values of family to be held at St. Bede's Episcopal Church in Santa Fe on December 29th at 6:30 p.m. Space is limited. For reservations, please call 424-3331. This celebration will benefit AXO, a youth group sponsored by the NAACP.